Hello, everyone. Good to be back with you. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Henrik Palmgren, your Swedish resistance fighter in the war against those who are seeking the loss of our lands all over Scandinavia, Europe, the Western world, the Occident, wherever Europeans have founded and built nations. If you missed our Red Eyes live stream this Saturday, the first episode of Weekend Warrior, it is now available archived on redeyesmembers.com. We've also made a few excerpts from it that you can see on redeyes.tv, our new and updated public website. Just go to the TV section or check it out on youtube.com/redeyesradio. Now, beyond the regular radio shows that we produce each week, you will now also, as a member, be able to tune in every Saturday live stream. This is video, by the way, as we discuss the week that's been, the news, and a lot of different segments and research lined up that we've wanted to do videos on. We'll also do selected shows where we take calls, have some more interaction with our audience, also do shorter interviews and other live or pre-recorded segments exclusive for this new edition. We're just getting started, so lots of good stuff coming. Definitely keep your eye on redeyesmembers.com. Our guest today is Julian Langness. He writes about European politics, fourth generation warfare, identity, masculinity, and society. He regularly contributes articles to a range of websites, including Traditional Right and Countercurrents, and is also the editor of EuropeanCivilWar.com. His first book that we'll be talking about today is Fistfights with Muslims in Europe. Julian, thank you so much for coming on Red Eyes Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Very, very good. Well, I'm looking forward to this. It's going to be a good show, I think. You contacted us a while back. You sent us a copy of your book, Fist Fights with Muslims in Europe. You have started to write for Countercurrents as well. A lot of things to discuss here. Very interesting book, by the way. Tell us first a bit about your background.
I was raised in America, but my family had all, we had all been descended from Norwegians, from Norway on my dad's side. And once I was a teenager, I decided to go travel in Norway and throughout Europe, and it had a marked impact on me, and that's largely what the book is about, along with some other issues. And then in the last couple of years, in addition to writing the book, I've also been writing for Countercurrents, and then right around the time the book came out in late January of this year, also started the website EuropeanCivilWar.com, just to try to understand what's going on in Europe, obviously with the very fluid situation there with the demographics and Muslims and everything else that is going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge issue. There's so many components, you know, to it, and we're going to try to break down some of those here today. But first, tell us a bit. So when did you kind of get aware of your Norwegian heritage? When did you start getting interested in this? Was this something that's been in your family for a long time, or did you kind of discover this, if you will, along the way?
I'd say the latter. I'd say definitely something I sort of discovered. I mean, obviously, I was aware that my dad's side of the family was Norwegian from, you know, the time I was a kid or whenever, as soon as I was old enough to kind of know those type of things. But I think, and one thing I really focus on or write about in the book is this sort of feeling or phenomena nowadays in the West. And I'm not sure, you know, to what it's like in Europe, because obviously, you guys aren't part of, you're not descended from immigrants the way we in America are. Some of the other, you know, Occident countries like Canada, New Zealand, Australia. But I think there's just a pronounced lack of identity for white people in those countries, in that we're not told, kind of glorious stories about our ancestors or really stories about our ancestors at all. I guess in the short term past, I mean, you know, we certainly learn about Ellis Island and kind of recent American history, but I just think it's another aspect of modernity that we don't focus on that. So I think it's a very normal urge for young people of European descent in America to either have a kind of a longing for that longing for tribe and identity and that sort of connection to the past that they aren't able to articulate, or that, in my case, that it was sort of semi-conscious. And I guess that just drove me to, you know, to try and research it and figure it out. And I knew by the time I was in high school, I really wanted to travel in Northern Europe, specifically Norway, since that's where we had come from, basically, on my dad's side. And I was actually supposed to be an exchange student there, but that fell through. And it was either when I was 16 or 17 that happened. I just convinced my parents to let me buy a ticket to Norway and fly over there on my own and just spend a month tromping around. And luckily, they acquiesced, and that kind of started my travels over there and my encounter with modern Europe and all the beautiful, wonderful parts of it and all the more horrifying aspects of it.
Yep, that is the truth. Well, you know, one thing that's funny, though, when you mentioned that about, you know, immigration or being an immigrant or whatever, they're actually trying to pin that on us these days, too, if you can believe it. I mean, obviously, you know, England, I could understand it a little bit since, you know, there is obviously some migration that occurred back in the migration age in the 500s-600s of the Angles and Saxons coming over. But they're even trying to pin that on us in Sweden these days that, you know, well, you took over the land after the Samis or whatnot. And they are hiding many of our stories growing up in Sweden. You know, that they definitely don't give you enough focus on our past and our history and our heroes. So bizarrely, we are very much in the same situation, if you can believe that. Strange, huh?
It's definitely fascinating. I wasn't aware of that, but I certainly am not surprised at all. I mean, I think any corners of their sort of religious ideology they can twist or turn or crumble to try to fit the narrative, is fair game, certainly.
That's true. That's true. All right. So what are we talking about here when you traveled over to Europe and Northern Europe in particular? How long ago was that now, your first trip?
The first trip was when I was either 16 or 17 years old. I'm 30 years old now, so it would have been in the early 2000s.
There you go. And tell us a bit about your experiences then. Obviously, this is what led you to write the book. This is how, you know, things came together. But give us some background on that and explain that to our audience of your experiences and on what happened when you were there.
Sure. Well, you know, and I think a lot of the insights that I've gleaned from it in the long run that I can articulate now certainly aren't things that I would have been able to explain or articulate then. But, you know, at the time I was 16 or 17 years old, and I like to think I was reasonably intellectual for being a teenager. But for the most part, I was just traveling and experiencing things, and just kind of absorbing it, like drinking from a fire hose, as they say. And you know, when I first landed there in Norway, I think my mom had somehow connected online with some folks there that she vaguely knew, and they had set up a place for me to stay, and it was with these two, I think 30-something female social workers in Oslo. And I talk about that in the book. And, you know, I kind of had my preconceptions of what I thought Norway would be like. And they were certainly shattered, you know, as they met me, or the one of them met me at the bus stop. And she's like, oh, yeah, okay, we're going to walk up to our apartment where you'll be staying. And she was so unbelievably nice. And we're walking up this hill, and all of a sudden there's these gigantic Stalinesque apartment buildings covered in graffiti, and the only people I see are Muslim women in hijabs. So it was definitely a culture shock and not what I was expecting. But so that was, you know, that was one big realization immediately. But I'm, you know, I traveled quite a bit in Norway then and in other parts of Europe later on. So I mean, I got to go to more rural areas where I guess it's still more similar to how it was back in the day. I mean, 50 or 100, 200 years ago, how our ancestors lived, at least, you know, in terms of day-to-day life and everything like that. And then our relatives who I visited were, you know, they still farm the land outside of Halden. So I think I got to see a pretty, you know, good, diverse picture of Norway on that trip. And it certainly opened my eyes. But I'd say more than any immediate realizations at the time, it just sort of put some sort of seeds of stuff in my head that just kind of stayed with me as I continued to grow and mature, you know, until this point. And I don't think until maybe the last couple of years I've ever reached a point where I feel confident kind of articulating, you know, what I think it means to be European or, you know, be part of the Occident these days, and really coming to terms with my thoughts on Europe and just figuring out how to situate myself in regards to all those things.
Yeah, the the socialism that has hit the northern European countries is a particular awful one, I would say. We obviously struggle with the very same issue in Sweden. I think Norway even were inspired by many things that Sweden did in the 40s and 50s and stuff like that. But so that caught you off guard, huh? That type of socialism, I guess you expected it to be more rural, maybe more quaint, maybe even some more expressions of maybe Norse heritage or something like that. Was that some of the things you expected?
Definitely. I mean, it's not like I had like huge preconceived notions. I mean, I loved all of it. I loved going there. It was wonderful. It's not like I came back and was bummed out or anything.
Sure.
It was a fantastic experience for a 16 or 17 year old to have. But yeah, it was interesting. I mean, there was sort of that dichotomy. And I grew up in a very small rural town in the Pacific Northwest. So it was interesting because all the Norwegians I met, the teenagers or people any age, I guess they assumed that coming from the United States, you must live in some gigantic, you know, metropolis like Los Angeles or Seattle. So they would constantly say things like, oh, well, Oslo must seem so small to you. And I was thinking, no, it seems absolutely gigantic. But
yeah, that's funny. It's funny. So the book is called Fist Fights with Muslims in Europe. One man's journey through modernity. Tell us about the title and tell us how that aspect of all of this got started.
Sure. Well, one of the things that happened or that impacted me, obviously, in the travels, and one of the parts of the book is just, I guess, what in real life is part of a kind of a broader awakening I had. I guess the way I've described it, like in the book, it's all kind of one single narrative. In real life, I sort of had these two I guess you could say journeys of awakening. And again, at the time, I never would have articulated it like that. But the one I'd say is more figuring out like masculinity or what it means to be a man, which again is, I think, something that whether they would phrase it like that or not is common to all young men in Western societies these days. Just because of you know, how our societies view masculinity. And I'm sure we can get into that later on.
Sure. Definitely.
But anyway, both in the United States and Europe for a period about 5 years, like in my early to mid 20s, it was sort of a period of awakening like that, but it was also kind of self-destructive, which I think is common to a lot of men. But anyway, for whatever reason, I just kind of got into this habit of allowing myself to get into fights with people. And, that's certainly a lot of other young men who kind of fall into that kind of pattern. And some of those were with Muslims in Europe. And it wasn't like I was going out and attacking someone. It was no different than in America. I mean, you're at, you know, a party or a club or even walking down the street. And, other guys will, start stuff with you. And for whatever reason, at that point, I just kind of made a habit of allowing that to happen and fighting with them, and it might range from a real fight where I got beat up to just a small little scrap or shoving. I think one of the books I talk about in my book is called The Professor in the Cage by Jonathan Gottschall, and I think he calls those cockfights or something like that, like when you see two men at a bar and they're kind of shoving and trading expletives. So in the book, it's all, everything's in Europe, just for the sake of the narrative. So it's changed very slightly. In real life, I think I probably got in about three fights of varying seriousness, while I was traveling in Europe with Muslims, and then more in America though. And then the other side of it would just be, which is also in the book, is kind of a journey of racial awakening and figuring out, kind of coming to grips with what it means to be a white man, in this day and age in America or in Europe, and all the complicated nature of that. So in the book, like I said, for the sake of making it readable, the narrative, I really kind of pushed those together and made them overlap 100%, whereas in real life, I'd say the overlap might be 60 or 70%. But that's where that side of the book comes from. And then from that, both in real life and the book, it just led to a lot of conclusions, not just about masculinity, but about Muslims and Europeans or white people in America and Europe. And thinking back on it now, I mean, it's, when I think about the fights, whether one's, in Europe with Muslims or in America, I mean, they're more just kind of comedic or silly or self-destructive is probably the right word than anything else. But they certainly do you know, have significance in my journey and just how I, you know, sort of figured out the world and my place in it, certainly.
Well, you know, the first, I want to talk about the introduction you have in the book. It's both funny in a certain way, and it's surreal the way you describe that fight. And to, again, in a very many ways, I can identify with it. I remember a few times when, just growing up in Sweden, we were living in an area that was very white. When you started to get a little bit older, you started going to you know, other parts of town, or you went to, you know, a bigger city that was close by or something. And I remember a few times where, you know, our gang of guys, of friends, encountered the immigrant gangs, if you will. And I just remember how violent they were. And it was something which was largely foreign to us. It was something that caught me off guard. It was nothing that I've been really prepared for in terms of other people in my circles, be that my parents or family or you know, even my older brother to a certain extent. It was kind of something weird, and it took me many years in hindsight looking back that it was like, oh, it was a different culture. It was a foreign people that was there and had very different ways from ours, you know. So I can identify with that. But tell us about that first fight that you had. I don't know if it's the first one, but you describe it in the book in the introduction. How did that come about? What happened there?
Well, the one that's in the introduction, that's from later on in the book, and it's sort of a mishmash of a couple different fights in Europe and even one from America. The first time I ever got really beaten up was a fight in America, and I sort of transposed that to that fight in Vienna in the book, which is, I did get in a fight there, but it didn't end like that. I didn't get, you know, beaten to a pulp, but I think that was a big part of it. And a lot like you said, I mean, I remember being a kid and you know, I would have given my left arm to avoid a fight. It was a terrifying thing. And I think that was one reason that I, you know, that became something later on that I was sort of trying to consciously will myself into is sort of exploring that fear, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
But then also, I mean, the other, I, you know, in my upbringing, it was nice though, because I mean, I also grew up in a very, very kind of tough working class logging town, and I was certainly exposed to fighting to a pretty huge degree in the town I grew up in. I mean, it was, you know, it was a lot of teenagers and younger, you know, 20 something men who, you know, worked as loggers, and on the weekends they went to parties or went to the bars and they got in fights. So I mean, I think I had been exposed to that sort of you know, that sort of outlook on the world, which I very much respect. And that's another big part of the book is that, you know, in a lot of ways, the conclusions that came about from my experiences was a real grudging respect for the Muslims. And certainly, you know, I would be happy or will be happy if we can eventually expel them from as many countries in Western Europe as possible. But I think there's certainly something to be said for the fact that they haven't lost that sort of martial spirit that our ancestors certainly possessed and that allowed our ancestors to thrive and survive and leave us in the world here. And I do think it's something that's been lost for our people. And I know, I think you were talking about that with Nick Griffin and Jack Sen, that for whatever reason, that's just been kind of dulled out of us in modernity. So I think it's a rational pushback that a lot of young men have to try to explore that. I think that's why we have so many young men who are joining MMA gyms and doing stuff like that. And I think that's very healthy. And I'm not that super pessimistic about the fate of our people in the long run. I mean, I think that certainly the way our culture has evolved at this point can only lead to death. But at the same time, I mean, I think that also means rebirth. I mean, if, you know, if we're not having any children, and I guess this is something we can get into later as well, but I mean, it's basically, I mean, throughout the history of the world, humans have either had to fight and struggle to survive or they perish. So,
yeah.
So overall, I'm not that pessimistic about how things stand.
Well, I think we've been domesticated in various ways. We've lost the aspect of what violence is, right? I mean, if we look in nature, we can see that, you know, lion cubs or what have you, they fight with their siblings, right? In many regards, we might do the same when we grow up. We fight with our siblings, we fight with, you know, our friends or whatnot. But society has kind of more or less bred this out of us, right? That violence is something really bad. You don't do it. avoid it to you know, as the plague. How do you think we've lost this, and how has this happened, Julian?
I think it's just the fact that for the last 50 years, at least since World War II, I think the West has just seen a period of prosperity absolutely unparalleled in the history of the world. And even President Obama was saying something about that the other day, that if you really look at things on a historical lens of like the last 2,000 years, how good things have been since World War II ended, you know, depending on how you look at it, have just been perverse. And I think that that is what's given rise to things like feminism, you know, things like nonviolence and just the very pacifistic nature of society in Europe and in the United States. And it seems like a little bit more so in Europe. But all those things disappear as soon as you're in a situation that has consequences. Like, one thing I'm really interested in, or that I'd like to write an article or a book about, is just how we as modern humans, how our actions and choices change, and the ways we interrelate to ourselves change almost instantly as soon as we get into a dangerous situation in which all these protective measures and shells we've created around us malfunction or disappear. Like on Flight 93 on 9/11, the one they, you know, they rushed the cockpit and they took it down so it couldn't hit anything. I mean, I always like to say, you know, as soon as that flight was hijacked, feminism went out the window. All those high-powered executive women, they were in the back, you know, getting supplies and stuff for the men, and the men were rushing the cockpit. And I think similarly in Europe, you know, right now we're beginning to get to a point in which actions have consequences, in which the law of the jungle has returned, because we're dealing with an enemy in terms of the Muslims, who they never left the law of the jungle behind. And as a result of that, I mean, we're seeing a huge pushback from the sort of, you know, cultural Marxist, like suicidalist governments like Merkel and David Cameron and the rest. But at a certain point, I just think that there has to be clarity. I mean, as the numbers of Muslims just keep increasing exponentially, and as the violence gets worse and worse, and as the Western European governments run out of money, I just think at a certain point it has to create a situation of clarity in which people are confronted with that, you know, that existential danger, and the societies, through whatever means, kind of very quickly and organically have to go back to states much like throughout the rest of human history. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I agree as well. I mean, I think danger, strife, you know, all these things that we've been shielded from such a long time. Once that begins to kind of dawn on people that we're in a situation like that, I think it will bring people together in a way that it hasn't before. It's almost like, you're right, that there is this process that we're going through is kind of like a cathartic, you know, what some people call, you know, a dark night, basically, of the soul, of the awakening of European and Western civilization, that we've gotten so astray, so far from our path. And It's this very aspect of an invasion, an ongoing invasion, and us being, you know, dispossessed and demographically pushed out. I think it's that that's going to waken us back into a kind of a true sense of ourselves again, that we attain and fall back to a role that we've been historically much more accustomed to. What do you think?
I agree absolutely 100%. That was another part of that same podcast I just referenced with Nick Griffin and Jack Sen, that I think you guys were saying, that, you know, as horrible and horrific as things are right now in Europe, and as they will become, I think there certainly is a positive as well, in that I think it will absolutely shock people back into a much more healthier existence. And I think that people truly do. I mean, as much as they want to hide from danger and suffering in the modern world, which I guess is sort of a normal impulse, I think people at the same time really do crave danger or such things, because that's what gives life meaning. There's a great quote, I can't remember if it's actually in the Iliad. I know it's in the movie Troy, so we'll just pretend it's in the Iliad, but about how, you know, the threat of death is what makes life so sweet. And, yeah. and imparts all that meaning to it. And I think that even in our entertainment, you can see that. I know Jack Donovan, who's someone I really quote at length in the book. I think he's just an absolute genius. But he talks about how even our fascination with zombie movies is in many ways a reflection of just the artificiality of our modern lives in the West, and the fact that we do crave danger, because that's one of the things that gives life meaning. Or even, you know, I was a big fan of the TV show Lost. I don't know if you ever watched that, but
sure.
That was, you know, 6-10 years ago, and I would watch it and just kind of wonder to myself why I liked it so much, and why, you know, I'd always find myself wishing that, you know, I could crash on an island like that. But it's the exact same thing, is that they're plunged back into a situation in which they need to work together and fight for survival. And that's something we're just so totally bereft of in real life. And I guess to try to kind of segue back to the book, that's another big theme of it, especially in the later chapters, because I kind of segue from my experiences with Muslims or the fighting or whatnot into a discussion of Islamism in general and terrorism and fourth generation warfare. But one thing I talk about is that, you know, as horrible and evil as those groups are, and as much as, you know, I'd gladly kill them with my bare hands if I could, you know, I do sympathize or sort of understand, I think, what draws a lot of young Muslim men, and in some cases young white men, to groups like Al-Qaeda. So then that's something the book really delves into. There's probably an entire chapter that sort of discusses that and discusses some real-life examples of Westerners, non-Muslim Westerners, who did convert to Islam and went to Chechnya or Afghanistan, etc. And I think that they are really searching for a lot of these same qualities we're kind of discussing now, and especially related to masculinity, because in the West, you know, they're not really given any outlets through which to chase, you know, those normal male instincts. And I think that they find an outlet through that, through Islamism or through joining these, you know, 4GW terrorist outfits like Al-Qaeda, in that they're able to have brotherhood, you know, which is something that is very much escapes us in the West. They're able to have danger in their lives. They're able to have an outlet for aggression, which is a totally normal male urge. They're able to have sacrality. I mean, they view their actions as sacred. They're able to have ritual, which is another thing we're bereft of. So, and they're able to have, I think, the same thing I was looking for when I went to Europe. And I think that a lot of our people are looking for is a connection, you know, to the past and to the future. They feel like they're fighting the same fight their ancestors did, and that they're fighting to leave a more glorious world for their grandchildren and their descendants. So I think that's very powerful, and I can very much sympathize with that. But then obviously the conclusion I come to in my book is that, you know, that might be something I understand and sympathetic to. But as far as modern Europe is concerned, I mean, I think that they are, certainly are existential, the number one existential threat. And yeah, we'll get more into that later, I'm sure. But certainly our primary opponent.
I mean, it's an artificially created situation. That's what's so interesting about this. I mean, equally, as you say, the Muslims are deracinated in the same way that we are when they come to the West. And that's usually why you have second and third generation Muslims who live in the West are the most extreme. It's not the first generation. It's those who have lived and grow up in the West. They, on some level, whether that's conscious or just kind of instinctual, they know that they don't belong. And so there's a tendency of these groups or these people to draw themselves more towards an organization, a group that is even more kind of extreme and ruthless. So what's funny about this, and to a certain extent, what's ironic is that these, what should we call it, this nonviolent religion that the West has adopted is creating a special kind of ruthless violence and terrorism that obviously these people who are behind this, the liberalism or whatever, they had no idea that this was going to be one of the consequences of what they try to create, right?
Absolutely. I think you 100% hit the nail on the head, and that's why it's so shocking isn't even the right word. I mean, it's just ridiculous when you you know, read or listen to a lot of these, you know, the spokesmen for the left-wing governments in Europe, and they're talking, they're wondering why these young Muslim men are rejecting assimilation. And it's so absurd. Why in God's name would they want to assimilate at all? I mean, first of all, the overall Muslim population is just on a complete upward trajectory to ruling Western Europe eventually. But even on the individual level, I mean, I think in European education and in the West, I mean, I think basically the narrative is that you know, white people are effectively evil. They're colonizers and exploiters. And we really teach kids of all races that is the fact. And, so I think it's very, very normal that a young Muslim man is certainly not going to buy into Western society. And really, there's nothing to buy into because we've rejected any sorts of things that make our countries or our cultures glorious or anything like that, that people would want to embrace as their identity. I mean, basically it's, you know, a lot of consumerism and that sort of thing without any lofty ideals. And I mean, certainly, you know, I read stuff about early American history like anyone else, and I can get emotional reading, you know, John Adams biographies or the Federalist Papers. I mean, I am very sympathetic to that too, but I think the idea of a multicultural sort of corporatist state in the West being able to instill any sort of loyalty within its citizens is really just not possible, because I think by definition, as a multicultural, multiracial entity, I think it's really just discarded the idea of a shared honor group, you know, being the makeup of society the way a lot of these societies used to be. And I think ironically, I guess to kind of segue into talk of fourth generation warfare, perhaps, or at least bring that up, is that, you know, like William S. Lind, kind of the father of a lot of this 4GW theorizing, you know, he predicts that the 21st century will really be the century of the nation state's disintegration, because by the nature of it, you know, with our mass travel and information society and the internet and massive amounts of immigration, you know, nation states are going to have a tough enough time as it is fostering a cohesive identity. So without really purposely trying to cultivate that and purposely, you know, taking sort of a really autocratic, in my opinion, nationalistic path, the way Poland and Hungary and Russia are, I think that it's going to be enormously hard for countries like the United States or Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom to retain any sense of cohesion or any sense, well, retain any sense of cohesion, because there won't be any real sense of shared identity amongst its citizens.
Exactly. Yeah, it's true. I mean, this is how they're destroying nationalism, of course. Again, and completely. I mean, okay, yes, we have travel. Yes, there are certain things that makes it much easier these days to kind of, if you be a cosmopolitan, right, a global citizen, if you will. But I think that not, you know, with the travel aside, I think also the governments that we're looking at here that are in power or elites, the establishment, are very keen on creating these kinds of. These kinds of conditions, right? They don't want nationalism anymore. They are seeking to create more of a globalized government. And at the same time, what's interesting is that within the countries, within these previous countries, there seems to be another level of tribalism and grouping and identity politics arising out of this situation as well, as a kind of a response to it, which means that the world I think we're looking at in the future is going to be when it comes to security and kind of management and administration, I think we're looking at a global level type organization. But on a more personal level, it looks like it's going to be more tribalism. Or how do we explain this world that is emerging out of all of this mess?
Yeah, I think you absolutely bring up what's one of the fundamental conditions and questions that humanity is going to be faced with in the next 100 years. And it's not unprecedented historically, but I think for the last 400 years or so, nation states and identity groups have had overlapping identities to extents that are, you know, not going to be the same anymore, and that weren't the case before that. I think that, you know, while politically there will be nation states, you know, of varying degrees cohesion and legitimacy and functionality over the next 100 years. I think there will be lots of identity groups that shift more and more away from a connection to any specific nation state. I mean, you know, as you have people traveling all around the world, you know, they're going to be a religious minority in their country, and they might very well, likely they will have, you know, much greater loyalty to that religious group than they do to that nation state, which is very, very problematic. You know, obviously one of the big problems we have in America and Europe. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It's just, that's just the case. I mean, I think that you and I are very much representations of that as well, or the alt-right, or, you know, white identitarianism, is that we're, and that's, I think, a big part of, I guess I don't talk very much about America in the book, but you know, I think that's an important issue or phenomenon right now, is that I think there's a lot of people who 50 years ago or 100 years ago would have been investing their loyalty more in their nation state. You know, you think of like the GIs in World War II, who are now looking for alternate places to invest that loyalty.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Now, before we go too deep here, a couple of things I want to ask you about, or one main thing here, I guess. And it's over this aspect of, you know, how you would describe the situation in Europe as it is right now, and what you think we can expect to happen, right? You know, we have newcomers that come to the show all the time. We do have to keep them in mind. We also have detractors, of course, listening, that we also have to keep in mind, and that we also have to kind of appeal to, if you will, of having having them trying to understand our position and why we're talking about these things and why we're concerned with this. So how would you describe this situation to someone who is completely behind on this issue, who just like, what are you talking about? Europe is fine, everything is going great. We're seeking to help as many people as we can, and in fact, it's our humanitarianism, our big heart, that's making us even better human beings. What would you say to a person like that?
That is a fantastic question, and not something I had thought about before the show. I guess I'm an example of that, being kind of in your bubble, forgetting there's other people who aren't as knowledgeable about it, but don't share the same opinions as myself. But it is something that I do often. Most of the people here in America who I talk about Europe with have absolutely no idea what's going on. I think if you asked, you know, 9 out of 10 people in America wouldn't even know that there are Muslims in Europe right now.
Right.
So, yeah, that's a great question. I'll totally dive into that. I mean, I think basically what's happened is that, and this is something I talk about in the book early on, kind of giving the background, but that starting in the 1950s and 60s, Europe, Western European nations started to allow a number of immigrants, predominantly from Muslim countries. Initially, a lot of those immigrants were, you know, the famous Gastarbeiters in Germany. They went there to perform kind of menial jobs. And initially they were mostly all 40, 50 year old men who didn't speak the language. But as time went on through family reunification policies, they were able to bring their wives and all their children. And obviously, as people with high birth rates, they've reproduced. And now, over the last, 30, 40 years, have come to represent a pretty darn large percentage of society. And I know that, a lot of times when people like me and you kind of talk about how things are nowadays, we'll be shouted down and people say, oh, they're only 8% of the population of XYZ country. And first of all, I think, a lot of the statistics are quite questionable. But the other thing a lot of people don't realize is the sort of demographic, quirks of this, in that, there's still a lot of elderly native European baby boomers who are a very large portion of society. But if you look at the percentage of men between the ages of 18 and 30, in Germany, Muslims will be a majority within that age group within the next 1 to 4 years. And there's a lot of other countries in Western Europe that are very close behind or even equal with that. And especially with the migrant crisis, in which the majority of the migrants or refugees or whatever you want to call them are young males. I think that the statistics I've read suggest 68% to 70%. But so basically right now in Western Europe, as you know, Henrik, obviously, as you know, far, far better than I do, there is, a large number of Muslim immigrants, and they have not assimilated by and large. And just as we were talking about, they very rarely, if ever, invest their own loyalty into the nation state, and for very obvious reasons. And that has led to a lot of very serious issues like terrorism and mass criminality, economic problems, mass rape. You know, we could get into that, but the statistics are just absolutely horrifying. And, you know, I think the reason for this is, despite all these problems, as you spoke about, the governing elites throughout most of Western Europe are completely 100% enthralled to this religion, I think is the only thing you can call it, of progressivism, cultural Marxism, or what I prefer to just call it, suicidalism. I think they basically just believe in and advocate for the suicide of Western Europe from a cultural, religious, and racial perspective. And I think it's just absolute zealousness. And I think certainly, as you implied, I mean, I think a lot of them phrase that through very benevolent, high-sounding terms, you know, like Sweden being a humanitarian superpower. But I don't think they're, you know, I don't think Sweden is doing anybody any favors. And obviously, you know, I haven't been to Sweden since I was 9. I mean, this is, you know, mostly from me reading and a lot of travels in Europe. But there's a lot of horrible things going on in Sweden right now. And I think that while through this urge to be a humanitarian superpower, who knows, they might have even done some good taking in some of these refugees. Surely they come from horrific conditions in some of their countries, the ones that truly are refugees. But they're creating a situation that can only end in absolute horror and bloodshed. The people that they're importing in come from regions of the globe that have seen nothing but constant ethnic warfare for as far back as any of us can trace, and that's being replicated in our countries. I mean, Countercurrents the other day, you know, published a review of Easy Meat, the book on the Rotherham issues that happened, occurrences, which estimates that over 100,000, basically little kids, girls between the ages of 11 to 16, have been basically groomed, enslaved, and gang raped for periods of years. I think the horror of it is so far beyond any of our comprehension. It's just absolutely sickening. And, you know, certainly in Sweden, I mean, I know in Stockholm, the local Muslims have been rioting and burning down cars basically every night for the last few months.
All the time.
You know, I think as the numbers of Muslims continue to increase, both through, you know, legal family reunification, Denmark is now letting a gentleman bring his 3 wives and 30 children there from a news report I just saw. So the Muslim population is exploding.
Let me insert this too in the discussion here. Yeah. Article recently out of, I think it was Daily Mail, the great mystery in Sweden, how do we suddenly have more men than women, right? It's like they're trying to say, well, what's the cause of this? It's a mystery. It's like, no, it's not. There's like tens of thousands of only males coming from, Middle East, North Africa, Syria, Afghanistan, all over the place. And this is, of course, what's doing it. But what would you say to someone who says, well, but we'll be able to change them, right? They come to the West, they will get liberalized, they'll be good little lefties at the end of all of this. What would you say to them?
I think that it is both. I think it's foolish. I think in a way it's vastly overestimating the appeal of modern Western European society. I mean, I think the reason most of these people are coming to the West is number one, economic reasons. They know they're going to get massive government benefits and be able to live much, much better lives from a material perspective because of the remaining strength of the economies, which is unfortunately very much on the wane as a result of many issues, but especially the migrant crisis. But I think that the idea that they're going to be swayed by the fact that, they can watch television and watch pornography and that their sons can, you know, grow up to be homosexuals, I don't think that's going to, make them want to jump at the chance to be Westerners. I think that truly there's not that many things that are attractive to Muslims about the West. I mean, there's a lot of things they can take advantage of, but the entire progressive left-wing narrative, I think, flies in the face of all those things that Muslims hold dear. I mean, they're obviously extremely conservative, traditionalist people. I mean, basically, if you think about the perversity of leftist thought, I mean, you know, leftists will spend hours haranguing, you know, evangelical voters in Iowa for being these barbaric religious conservatives who yet, you know, their conservatism is 1/1000th of these Muslims who think that homosexuals should be dropped in off buildings and everything like that. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers the question, but I think that a lot of it is just this sort of religious conviction that's propagated through the public schools. And I think, you know, and that's another thing I sort of talk about in the book, and I think that does get written about quite a bit on the alt-right or on various journals, is kind of what constitutes that break from that way of being brought up within the sort of leftist progressive cultural Marxist narrative to sort of having that awakening. And I think it's very natural and organic. I mean, I think all it takes is just intellectual honesty and common sense to realize that this multiculturalism, this monster we've created in Europe, it is truly horrible and is only destined to become more horrible. And I think, I guess to round back to your original question, what's wrong with it is that even if we will say that the motivation to allow in all these Muslims was totally benevolent, which in many cases, you know, I think that's fair, a fair assumption. I think that it can only end in just complete fourth generation warfare, basically civil war. And when I say civil war, I don't mean wars between nation states or what William S. Lind would call, you know, third generation warfare, the kind of thing we saw 100, 200 years ago, but basically various groups within a society, non-state actors, at war with either the government or each other. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing in Europe right now with terrorism and the mass criminality and the mass rape. And I think that'll just continue to get worse and worse as time goes on.
Now, this is very interesting. There's a few things I want to discuss here, but where do you think the government would be in all of this? What would their role be, if you will? I mean, we have potentially then we have the invaders, these quote refugees, the migrants, whatever you want to call them, have a kind of a default antagonism, both against us, the people of Europe that have let them in, but also on the same time, the governments that also, of course, is enabling these people to, get handouts and everything else that our nations offer them. Then, of course, we have many of our own antagonistic anti-white leftists, if you will, the Europeans within our own countries that are vehemently against us, who oppose this invasion and for and with, you know, these invaders, if you will, that would stand with them, it seems like. But then the government, I mean, let's assume that there was some kind of conflict here then between a rising tide of nationalist groups that are starting to exhibit more and more hostile behavior, shall we say, against these invading groups. What side do you think the government would take in all of this?
That's a great question, and that's what I spend a lot of my time thinking about. And that kind of goes back to what we were talking about before, and just I guess that's a topic of particular interest to me. I think all of us who are very concerned and horrified by what's going on in Europe, you know, sort of filter that through different lenses, different creative lenses. And, you know, I spend a lot of my time thinking about and writing about the situation from more of a strategic fourth generation warfare perspective, because I guess that's just how I filter it. I'm certainly not any more qualified to do that than anybody else. I guess have a predilection for diving into these kind of, you know, dry treatises on warfare and society and really trying to read about other, you know, fourth generation warfare theaters that the world has seen over the last 50 years, like, you know, like the Balkans in the early 90s, yeah. Lebanon, Palestine, Afghanistan, and trying to figure out what lessons we can impart that we can then extrapolate to the situation in Europe to try to better understand it and better orient ourselves to it. And I guess before I dive into your question, you know, that's a lot of this, you know, fourth generation warfare stuff that William S. Lind talks about is kind of taken or built upon theories of Colonel John Boyd. And I'd encourage anyone listening to this to look up both those names, William S. Lind and Colonel John Boyd. And Colonel John Boyd was a military strategist and created what's known as the OODA loop. And a lot of people have probably heard of that, but it's basically just kind of a matrix or filter for understanding decision making. And it's now been applied from everything to the military, to business and marketing and all sorts of stuff. But basically, it's pretty simple. It's just it's OODA, and it stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, Act. And of course, you can dive into it and to all the particulars, and it's massively more complex than that. But I think with this very fluid situation we see in Europe right now, that's basically what everyone is doing, but what our side is doing, our side being people that want to preserve Europe and preserve, you know, our lands, our heritage, our cultures, is I think we're observing these very, very quick changes, very fluid changes, the situation in Europe, and basically trying to orient ourselves to it. I mean, that's kind of what me and you are doing right now. Are we part of the government that's dealing with this? Is that where our loyalty lies? And I would argue it doesn't. I mean, I think basically I agree with what you were saying, and I'll build on it. But basically, I think there's three groups to sort of simplify it. I mean, there's the Muslims that are coming in, who I think are for the most part basically a fourth generation force. I mean, for their huge numbers, they're remarkably unified. I mean, you very rarely hear, you know, Islamist theologians really attacking these in the street Muslim criminals who sell drugs. And similarly, you very rarely, I mean, you know, even the Muslim criminals look upon the Islamist preachers with real reverence. So it's remarkably unified group. And I think they're very invested, obviously, in the governments of Western Europe falling, because they, you know, in varying degrees, I think they either are trying to create, you know, trying to take over Europe, or on the other end, they might not care that much, but they certainly wouldn't be unhappy with Muslims taking power in Europe in, you know, 10, 40, 60 years, whatever. But I think to answer your question about the governments, I think, you know, most of the governing parties, the governments of Western Europe right now, are to varying degrees, like I said, just enthralled to this complete religion of multiculturalism and miscegenation, you know, leftism, all this stuff, feminism. I think I do like the term cultural Marxism. Some people don't prefer that term, but I think it makes sense. I mean, just as economic Marxism sought to overturn historical power structures related to economics and return power to the oppressed or whoever, I mean, I think in the modern parlance and in the modern leftist narrative, it's all about taking people who have been, you know, quote unquote, powerless socially, societally, and giving them power over the so-called oppressors, which is, you know, basically me and you. It's white men, right? Heterosexual white men. So I think that in this religion, it's all about giving women power over men, giving homosexuals power over heterosexuals, etc. And for whatever reason, Muslims seem to have become like the most celebrated honor group at all that sort of holds sway over any of them, which is a little bit perverse when you think about it. But for whatever reasons, that seems to be the case. So I do think that, I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, none of us would complain at all about a right-wing, you know, anti-immigrant, you know, I like the term preservationist political party attaining power. I mean, I would have been thrilled if Norbert Hofer won the presidency in Austria, and if, if that party could have taken power in 2 years, I'd be thrilled if Marine Le Pen wins in France. But I think we also have to acknowledge the fact that in a lot of these countries, because of the huge numbers of Muslims, even were a party to take power and essentially want to copy what Poland and Hungary are doing and really, you know, try to foster nationalism and cohesion and try to expel large numbers of these Muslims, I think that would only lead to violence and conflict as well. So I think that basically, I think our side, people that want to preserve Europe, are essentially, whether we like it, also a fourth generation force, in that our goals are not congruent with the goals of any Western European government, at least the current governing parties of any Western European government. And I'm certainly not, I mean, you know, the name of the website's EuropeanCivilWar.com. I mean, I in no way am like cheerleading that I want war. I mean, war is more horrible than we can imagine. It's just trying to figure out what's going to happen. And at least for me, I really don't foresee a lot of outcomes that don't end in pretty horrific situations. And as a result, I think that the only intelligent thing to do is try to prepare for that and just do whatever we can to kind of prosecute our goals in an honorable way that will hopefully achieve the most positive outcomes for our people.
Well, we need to end up in a situation where we appreciate upholding our culture and tradition. And learning to enjoy to defend that. There's of course a lot to be said about that. And really, we're just kind of getting into it here, you know, Julian. This is getting really interesting. And so we have much more to discuss. But what I think we should do is take a break here in a few minutes. But tell us a bit about EuropeanCivilWar.com, the website, and also, of course, where people can go to pick up a copy of the book we're talking about here, Fistfights with Muslims in Europe, One Man's Journey Through Modernity. Tell us where people can get a copy of the book.
Absolutely, yeah. So to get a copy of the book or to read some reviews of it, they can go on Amazon.com. As of today, that is the only outlet for purchasing it, but hoping to also get it on a few other ebook readers, and then also having my book formatter set up the physical copy of it right now. So there should be a physical copy coming out in July. But to buy a copy of it, it's on Amazon right now. It's actually only 99 cents, so it's not going to break the bank, and that's very purposeful. I mean, right. Certainly one of the goals of the book is just to educate people on the situation in Europe. So the more people that buy it and can read about it and form their own opinions on what's going on, the better. But yeah, Amazon.com and Julian Langness, Fistfights with Muslims in Europe, One Man's Journey Through Modernity. And then EuropeanCivilWar.com is the website I created. And basically the goals of the website is pretty similar. It's just to try to understand what's going on in Europe, to track the progression of events, analyze it from sort of a strategic, fourth generation warfare perspective. And like I said, I mean, I don't have any formal education in any of that whatsoever. It's just basically, it's just a reflection of my journey trying to understand that. I mean, I think like a lot of us, and surely like you, I guess I just feel that being who I am as a white person alive right now, that I certainly owe it to our ancestors and to my son and to all of our future descendants to do whatever I can to at least understand what's going on and hopefully impact it in any small way that I can.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it self-published or is it through Countercurrents? How did you publish the book?
It's self-published. Yep.
Excellent. Yeah, that's the way to go these days, I think.
Absolutely. I wouldn't have done it any other way. I think I love self-publishing. I think it's huge. I think it's a reflection of a lot of developments that can only benefit our movement as information becomes, far more available and there's less power brokers to have to deal with to get it out there.
Yeah, less middlemen, definitely. So, yeah, folks, we'll have a link obviously up to the Amazon page where you can get a copy of the book, Kindle. And I always say this when there is only a Kindle version available, that you don't have to have a Kindle to read it. Amazon offers obviously a method to read it right through a web browser, basically on any device as well. So definitely don't shy away from that if you don't have a Kindle. There's a good review as well on Countercurrents. I'll add a link to that. And then, of course, also to EuropeanCivilWar.com. What do you do? You have some plans for the websites and updates and whatnot? I think I saw a podcast coming. Tell us about that.
Yeah, definitely hoping to or intending on getting a podcast going soon, and probably be focused on the same stuff a lot of the sites focused on is just trying to understand things from a strategic perspective. I really want to interview, if possible, authors who have written about other conflicts like in the Balkans, Lebanon, Afghanistan, like I mentioned, because I think that reading that type of thing, whatever happens in Europe, I think that can only benefit us to have more historical knowledge and hopefully interviewing people in Europe and just trying to cultivate as much understanding and perspective on everything as possible.
Yeah, great. We need that strategic awareness for sure, and looking at other examples. Well, let's get into some of those points here after we take a short break as we pick up in the second segment. So stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us, Julian. We'll be right back after a short break. We'll be right back. We'll pick this up in the second hour with Julian and continue to discuss the fate of Europe, the refugee invasion, and how this is going to take shape in the years to come. We also talk about feminism, how masculinity has been undermined in liberal, social, democratic countries all throughout Europe, now paving the way for a largely resistance-less invasion. However, we've not seen any organized opposition to the actions that our traitorous politicians have enforced on us, so this can and will radically change once this occurs. So this is far from over. You can hear the rest of this interview and any of our previous ones, including our videos, films, inside episodes, and of course our new live show, Weekend Warrior. Go to redicemembers.com and sign up for membership if you haven't already. Next on Red Eyes Radio, we have Andrew Fraser, author of The Wasp Question. Definitely don't miss that one. All right, well, thank you for listening. We'll take a short break here, and we'll see you on the other side.